This week, the Mincing Rascals start in Chicago. Hi, it's John Williams. Although the pull of what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the country is really great. And once again, at the start of this week's podcast, Eric Zorn pulls me off center. We eventually right the ship. We talk about Lori Lightfoot's desire to not have protesters on her street and not have National Guardsmen in the streets of Chicago. We do not mention it, but there is a word you cannot say on the radio or TV, and if you say it, you'll probably get fired. The Tom Brenneman story. We close with a discussion about the Democratic National Virtual Convention, and Austin Burke had some fascinating statistics about what you do and don't know about COVID-19. Here's what I know about knee pain. It really hurts. Go to the Joint Relief Institute, and they will address it for you. The Joint Relief Institute in Orland Park and Oak Brook uses digital imaging. They see where the tissue's deteriorated, and then they put a lubricant right there, and it really, really works. You know, we've just had the loveliest of summers, and now going into the fall, I want you to be able to take advantage of any and every single day that you can pain-free. Lord knows you need it this year. If you go to the Joint Relief Institute, they see where that tissue's gone away. They put a lubricant in there, and it works. Pain-free, non-surgical procedure, and it's almost surely going to be covered by your insurance. They got somebody to help you out with that. So with confidence, limp in there and then smile on your way out. Here's how you reach them, jointreliefinstitute.com, or call 708-888-0000. Zero as in zero pain. Today is Thursday. It's August 20th, 2020, the worst year ever. I'm John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals. By the way, for those of you keeping score at home, it's 1:37 in the afternoon, and you can listen to me weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW.
I'm Austin Burt from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Radio Newsroom.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the Tribune columnist known to his colleagues as Z Anon.
See, he did it. There he did it. And so the president today, right? There are a lot of good people in QAnon.
A lot of good people. But he's protecting us. So a reporter said something to Trump like, do you really think that, are you protecting us from child pedophile rings? And
at the crux of the theory is this belief that you are secretly saving the world from this satanic cult of pedophiles and cannibals. Does that sound like something you are behind?
Well, I haven't heard that, but is that supposed to be a bad thing or a good thing?
He said, well, what's wrong with that?
What's he going to say, though? No? I'm letting him run rampant?
It was a really
bad question.
Phrased question.
The QAnon movement appears to be gaining a lot of followers. Can you talk about what you think about that and what you have to say to people who are following this movement right now?
Well, I don't know much about the movement other than I understand they like me very much, which I appreciate. But I don't know much about the movement. I have heard that it is gaining in popularity, and from what I've heard, these are people that love our country, and they just don't like seeing it.
But I think you learn to distance yourself from the fringe elements of your party if you were a serious person, and I think that Trump has forfeit the claim of being a serious person.
Is this how you plan to start, John?
No.
It's never happened to John McLaughlin, you know.
Morton!
Wrong!
All right, well, let's start where I wanted to start, and maybe we'll get to some of that stuff. Is it somewhat hypocritical for Mayor Lori Lightfoot to get extra police protection for her block while she refuses to ask for National Guard help for the rest of the city? A handful of aldermen want the city to petition the governor to help Chicago police out for maybe 4 months, and Lori Lightfoot said that's grandstanding. At least that's my read on this thing.
You know, one of my cool memories from high school was I'd go to the Sox game. I grew up in Manteno. And then after the game, I would drive down, I think it was at Lowe, or wherever old Mayor Daley lived, and Sis Daley was still alive. Richie Daley wasn't mayor yet. But Sis Daley, for the rest of her life, had a police car sitting outside her house long after the Daleys or between the Daley administrations. So I think this idea of protecting a mayor, especially when he's under threat, shouldn't be that big of a deal.
I'm not going to make any excuses for the fact that given the threats that I personally receive, given the threats to my home and my family, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that they are protected. And I make no apologies whatsoever for that.
Is it that simple, Heather?
I think it's a little bit apples and oranges. So the mayor was asked about this morning, and she basically said, look, you don't see the threats that I see on a daily basis. And I'm not going to apologize for, you know, taking steps to keep my wife and 12-year-old daughter protected. And let's not forget that she is the first Black woman to be elected Chicago mayor. She's the first openly gay mayor of Chicago. I imagine that the threats she gets on an hourly basis would turn my stomach. But even if she were to ask Governor Pritzker to call out the Illinois National Guard, Governor Pritzker has said under no circumstances would they be used to police the city. They would be used in a way that they were during the George Floyd protests at the end of May and the beginning of June, where they were used for sort of crowd control and to block off neighborhoods and as sort of like supplemental to the police officers. Because let's remember, National Guard troops are not trained to police anywhere. They don't know what the consent decree requires. They don't know what the departmental orders require. And it's really, many people say, a recipe for disaster, especially in a city where you have a significant police brutality problem. So it's apples and oranges. And I will say that it's not surprising that it's Alderman Lopez and Beal who are at the heart of this call for a special meeting. Although I personally am delighted by it, because as best I can tell, it's never happened before. So I am here for special meeting drama.
Yeah, well, whatever his motivation is, Lopez told us, fine, I'll go ahead and just use them in a support capacity. We don't need them to be CPD. But free up CPD. But maybe he has more of an agenda than just that. Eric, what's your read on this?
Well, about security at the mayor's house, I've got a good friend who lives about three doors down from the Lightfoot Eshelmans. And the times that I visited him there during normal times, there's like two cop cars out there. It's not excessive security, doesn't seem to me. And when you have protesters gathering at the nearby intersection and trying to go in front of her house, I think it's perfectly appropriate to have security there to keep her safe, keep her child safe, keep her wife safe. I have no problem with that. And again, for the National Guard, I think you call that out on special occasions when there is severe disruptions and you need these troops to preserve order. And Heather is exactly right. The National Guard is not trained to be police. It's not. You don't want them sitting on your street corners day in, day out. That sends a bad message, and it's a sign of a city in complete collapse, which I don't think we are yet.
Huh. But Austin, it seems to me like if the police aren't there, then these elements surface, and then they come after the fact. So doesn't it make some sense to have a stepped up police presence, which the National Guard could enable?
I guess it depends how much they would enable. So Chicago has one of the highest rates of officers per capita of any major city. We're much higher than a lot of our peer cities. So I think it's an easy knee-jerk reaction to say, bring in more people with guns to police the streets or to even provide a support capacity. It's not clear to me that the existing resources are being deployed effectively. And I think that's a function of many decades of having more of a politicized police department than a professionalized police department. And that gets into the whole question of, so we talked about the federal consent decree, right? Right now, I was just talking about this with someone yesterday. Who's responsible for implementing the consent decree? You've got a mayor and an FOP with their heels dug in on both sides. You've got a police chief who doesn't have time to like go to the bathroom. What you want and what LA did was have a commission that's professional, that's appointed by the mayor, but very difficult to remove. They're responsible for getting all of these reforms into shape. Right now, I don't expect Chicago to make much progress at all in professionalizing the police. If it's constantly a question of like whether we're going to get in the National Guard or if there's cops outside the mayor's house.
You think that it's embarrassing to Chicago or to the mayor if we have to have the National Guard? That must send the worst of signals, right?
Well, I mean, it's weirdly sort of counterintuitive, right? Because if we need the National Guard because our police department isn't capable of policing the city, then, you know, what are we even doing by saying we need more police or them deployed in a different way? I mean, the issue is not that, you know, nobody's out there saying we don't have enough police. You know, Chicago has more police per capita of than both New York or Los Angeles. And if the issue is that the people of Chicago don't trust the police department, adding another sort of organization that's not connected to the community would seem to be counterproductive. And also, let's not forget that until this year, the last time the National Guard was called out to Chicago was 1968. So, you know, this is not something that is routine or is something that happens every day. And there's also the state police, which helped during the looting a couple weeks ago.
But when it just pops up like that, Eric, I don't know what any police department could do. Was it a function of bad policing, or could any police department have prevented what took place two
weeks? Are you talking about the August 10th, that the Sunday into Monday, a week and a half ago, whatever it was?
I'm kind of talking about them all, but I mean, pick one.
That one, they were clearly outnumbered, and I don't know if on the spur of the moment, I think, Heather, you may have this memorized. Did they send 400 police officers downtown?
Right.
And they probably needed about 1,200 to figure out what to do. I don't think they had a good strategy for cordoning off the area, figuring out what was going on. There was an effort, and I think they want to increase the effort in monitoring social media, because this stuff gets started and organized, such as it's organized, on social media. And then there are people who are complaining that the cops shouldn't be monitoring social media. They should be putting their resources elsewhere. I would disagree with that. I would think that the evidence shows that it would be really smart to have as much monitoring of social media as you can, because a lot of these feuds, a lot of this mayhem gets started on social media. So I think it was more of a question of just being caught a little flat-footed. Then you got to ask yourself what happened last weekend in the loop with the protest downtown and the alleged kettling, which our reporter Paige Fry did a pretty vivid account of what happened to the protesters there, where they got hemmed in by police, and there was very little, if any, looting there, but the police seemed to have reacted in a very heavy-handed way. Now, I wasn't there, and I've read both sides, but the police did not seem to be caught flat-footed then. A broader answer is that we probably do have enough officers to handle these eruptions of violence. The question is, how do we handle the day-to-day?
Right, and so and the idea that we're going to have 400 National Guard troops and that they're going to know where to be, you know, I mean, if we had an extra 1,000 cops on the street last weekend, right, or the weekend before, I think that's, people are maybe putting a little too much hope in that. It's not the solution they're looking for.
I don't know if it's fair to second guess them like that, to say, well, you should have known, you should have had 1,400 officers down there instead of just 400. Is that fair to say? Did they have evidence to suggest that that wouldn't have been a massive overreaction?
You know, it's interesting to me too, then the Sun-Times did a couple of stories this week. If it was in the Tribune, I didn't see it, but they're sort of following what happens to some of the people that broke into those high-end retail stores, got some merch, and now what are they doing with it? And they're fencing it. Sometimes online, some undercover cops are acting as purchasers, and they're able to catch these people. And then what do you have but a really relatively small retail theft that doesn't require a lot of bond, and those people are out again pretty soon, and nothing happens, right? So you sort of die a death of a million cuts. This person did that, but nobody is responsible for the totality of it. And so nothing really large happens. Nothing changes. This is my rant on the air this morning to an attorney. And I'm like, what can we do to have the punishment fit the crime? Because it's a bunch of little crimes.
And he went after Kim Fox.
She's also raised the limit for the minimum for felony theft from $300 to $1,000. That's just among the many changes she's put into place that we're seeing reflected now. And even if you were to take that Kim Fox came in with that mandate, shouldn't she throw that aside in the wake of what's just basically terrorism, you know, to your point, tearing our city apart?
And that was not a setup. I don't know what the answer is. Austin, what's your reaction to that?
There's a balanced approach, and it's all about making, if you kind of have to take an economic perspective about incentives, right? So you would think that a punishment, for example, you know, retail theft under a certain dollar amount, that's a tough rule, because then if you're a a guy who's stealing a phone, for example, because these don't go with inflation, right? But if you're stealing an iPhone from someone, that could be, who knows, you know, $500, $600. And that could be a felony charge. And maybe it should be, maybe it shouldn't. But there should be a really intense discussion around what the felony theft thresholds are, because that really does seem what it comes down to, at least in the Chicago conversation, is like there's not enough prosecution of kind of these petty thefts. There's also a question of you have the prosecution rate and then you have what the punishment is. What we saw in the Tribune story was that the prosecution rate, like even going after the cases, had gone down. That to me seems like a problem. I wouldn't see someone like Anita Alvarez as an especially, red meat, really aggressive prosecutor. And for her successor to have an even lower prosecution rate, I think is cause for concern. And you don't have to be like a Trump all caps law and order person to think that way. That's just basic. That's a basic functioning of the criminal justice system. There has to be punishment for crime.
Well, of course, Kim Fox's rationale for that is that you've got, when you put somebody in prison or put somebody in jail, I should say, for retail theft, there's a disruptive ripple that comes out from that. They may lose their job. They may they may get sick in jail. Their families may suffer from this. And so the idea of figuring out other ways to punish them, to keep them in the home setting, to allow them to keep employed, and to try to rehabilitate them rather than just punish them. Yeah. I don't think it's not necessarily an ill-considered idea or a naive idea, but when you run into a situation like we have here, it's problematic because it's like you guys say, well, okay, you stole $500 worth of merchandise, go and sin no more, or I'll fine you $1,000 and you can't pay it. It's difficult. My feelings about Kim Fox, aside from the Justice Smollett case, are fairly positive. They're mixed, but fairly positive. I think she's got some good ideas about trying to make the justice system focus on the things that are actually threatening to people, that actually are causing harm to people. And
they're good ideas that come at a terrible time.
Yeah,
you're right. This is a really bad time to talk about being lenient for shoplifters.
Well, it sounds good when she describes it, and maybe in a classroom it sounds good. But then when everybody goes out and shoplifts at the same time through a smashed window, you don't just have lost boots. There's plywood on storefronts downtown still. The ripple effect of that night is millions of dollars to this day.
But do you think
all we get is $1,000 bond from somebody?
My question or my issue with all of this is that, and you get callers to this effect all the time, is, oh, it's, Fox, they know they're not going to get busted. They know that. Do you really think that the people breaking through the windows at Burberry or wherever knew that if they stole less than $300, they wouldn't get busted for a felony? I doubt that that was in most of their minds.
I think people, word spreads, right? If I had a friend who I knew stole XYZ, or a couple of friends or a few other folks that I knew, and they got X punishment or didn't get X punishment, I think I would know. Similar to parking violations or something in Chicago. If you go, on this street, you're going to get a $50 ticket. So, you don't want to mess around there. I wouldn't underestimate people's ability to perceive risk when committing crimes.
Yeah, but then what do you do with that, right, Austin? I mean, so then you say, okay, well, then we'll crack some heads. We'll put you in jail for 6 months or whatever. Throw the book at them. Or I'm literally legislatively interested in creating new crimes that they commit when I get upset watching TV. And Fox says that doesn't help. That just perpetuates the problem.
What you can't do is eliminate all discussions of personal responsibility when it comes to committing crimes. And that's what happened with the Black Lives Matter activist who was talking about how this is, we're looting back and looting is reparations. Or I don't know if you saw, I think Jamal Green, former mayoral candidate, tweeted the video of that young man, and people were saying kind of like, what are we doing to help him? And it's like, well, there needs to be some kind of consequence for that kind of behavior. Or else, as Steve says, like, I don't like the discussion where we say, well, property doesn't matter as much as lives. Nobody's arguing that. But if you live in a city where there's not respect for basic property rights, odds are there's not going to be respect for people's lives either. It's a very fine line. Well, and any of these looting episodes could have ended in someone's death easily. And we are lucky that it did not.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, and there's also the idea that when you have crimes like this and you have an environment in your downtown where merchants are afraid to relocate, that you begin draining a lifeblood out of a neighborhood. And that, you know, downtown provides a lot of jobs, a lot of tax revenue, some of which arguably not enough, but some of which goes into these dispossessed neighborhoods. And if you start saying, well, we're going to make sure that businesses don't locate on Michigan Avenue because they don't want their windows smashed and their stuff stolen all the time, you end up, I mean, it's not, I mean, I know these people aren't thinking strategically, and they're not thinking like, well, gee, if I loot this store, then perhaps the tax base will be impeded. But there is, I mean, for those of us who are sitting here Monday morning quarterbacking this, we can see that you know, this is such that, you know, when you are looking at a problem like this, you need to make sure that you create a city and you maintain a livable city. And that's the paradox. That's the dilemma that the police department has, that the prosecutor's office has, that the mayor has, which is how do you talk about law and order like it's this terrible thing, because Trump tweets it in all caps. But order is something that we rely on, that poor folks rely on order. Poor folks may need order in their communities more than I need it in my community, enforced order. And so if you lose order, if you lose that sense of order, whether it's through not prosecuting smaller crimes or whatever, then you begin to lose your residence. You begin to lose your city. And that's another problem that they need to deal with. So,
well, Steve and I come downtown every day, and if you add COVID to what's been happening in the streets on the weekends, a guy here at work described it as it's starting to look more and more like Detroit all the time. It's not getting better fast, is it, Steve? I mean, it's weird lately how barren downtown is.
Well, I think most of that's the pandemic. I do, but it's discouraging to see stores that clearly could have afforded to deboard by now, and they've chosen not to. I mean, we're sitting just across the river is a Whole Foods store that has been boarded up since May, I think. You know, they just, they must be waiting for the next wave. I don't know. There are others on my drive in. You know, where I see they're just going to leave them, their stores boarded up.
That's awful. What's the old saying? Shame on you if you loot me once. Shame on me if you loot me twice.
That's exactly the saying.
Some of these places are going to go, we're going to be a plywood front for a while now because we're stupid if we make ourselves that vulnerable.
But I don't feel afraid to be down here.
Not at all.
No,
I don't.
No, it's just sad.
Yeah.
I was down there last week. I totally agree. And the first thing I thought of was a few years ago, Steve Brown, Madigan spokesman, we had him on some radio interview. And we're talking about how the jobs numbers are really bad. Chicago has all these, you know, really, really big looming problems. And he's like, I see cranes all over the place in downtown Chicago. And the point is, and I said this in our book, The New Chicago Way, as well, like the successes often stumble. The problems don't stumble. The debt stays there. And when you have a crisis like this, it's made exponentially worse because of all the bad decisions that have been made before this.
Speaking of Kim Fox, and her name has come up here a little bit so far, Cook County Special Prosecutor Dan Webb says that there's no need for criminal charges against the state's attorney's office handling of the Jussie Smollett case. Is that a succinct description of what's come down, guys?
That is the most favorable
summary
of that report that I can imagine.
If I can quote Dan Webb, she doesn't belong in jail, and that's a victory.
You've established a very low bar for what happened here. I mean, what Webb found was that she messed up on the law and she lied to the public about her handling of the Smollett case. He couldn't figure out, so for some reason, he talked to, I guess, you know, her prosecutors and her, I assume. We don't know. We haven't seen this full report. And he couldn't figure out what happened. And there's this gap. There's this 19-day gap that we're talking about. And I don't need to refresh anyone's memory. All listeners to the Mincing Rascals remember the Jussie Smollett case. But there's a 19-day gap between when he was charged with 16 counts of disorderly conduct by Kim Fox's office and the day where they suddenly and without any notice dismissed all those charges and let him walk down to the lobby of the Layton courthouse and proclaim his innocence and victimhood.
I've been truthful and consistent on every single level since day one. I would not be my mother's son if I was capable of one drop of what I have been accused of. But I am a man of faith, and I am a man that has knowledge of my history, and I would not bring my family, our lives, or the movement through a fire like this.
There's that 19-day gap, and nobody's been able to figure out even now what happened in those 19 days to make her change her mind. But that is where he gets into the misconduct so much as fishy conduct by Fox. And I think, and he is referring his findings, I believe, to the Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission. So,
right. She could lose her license, right?
She could lose her law license. And I don't know, does that make you ineligible to be a state's attorney? I don't know.
I don't think so.
No,
not here anyway.
Electoral requirement that the state's attorney be a attorney in good standing with the Bar Association.
It would be a memorable story, though, right? Wouldn't it?
Does it help if you're an attorney in bad standing?
Well, I mean, look, I wrote about this earlier this week, and my view is that Kim Fox just owes us an explanation as to what happened here. Why did she do what she did? What Webb did say was that he found no evidence that she was trying to curry favor with the Obamas or somebody else, that this was somehow a corrupt decision that she made. My guess, is that what she decided to do was let him go in order to illustrate what we were talking about earlier, that she is not interested in these little stupid crimes. And Jussie Smollett's allegedly fake hate crime was a stupid crime, stupid little crime with no physical victims. And so she was going to illustrate by letting him go that were her priorities.
Then. So she was going to spotlight her priorities by this.
She thought she was going to shine a light on her excellent priorities. And nobody around her figured out and said, no, this is an internationally famous case right now. You don't just drop it for no reason. But she didn't figure that out, and she did it, and now she won't. It just sort of copped to it. And this is absurd. This crime happened, I think it was in January of 2019. All the craziness in court handed it happened in March 2019. It's August of 2020, and this story is still making headlines. She's facing re-election in 2.5 months, and I think she could easily be in trouble over this.
The question of whether it was like malice or incompetence is actually like, it would almost be more concerning to me if this was entirely an idea of her office, that this was good. Like that speaks more to incompetence versus the other way being like, oh, well, it's Chicago. Someone pulled some strings and, you know, they did this. That's a really sad statement to make, but
I don't think anyone pulled strings. I don't think Kim Fox would have risked her political career to let some B-list actor off of a minor charge. I mean, I know he had 16 counts, but he was never going to spend a day in prison. He was going to pay a fine. He was going to have to plead guilty, and that was going to be it. We'd have forgot. His name would be the answer to a trivia question right now.
The one thing, though, about always the response when we're talking about her, like people are saying she's soft on crime, the argument is, well, there's more resources to prosecute more serious crimes. The thing with the Tribune story that I keep saying to people is it's for felony sex crime cases. She dropped 9.5% of those when her predecessor dropped 6.5%. So she had a 50% higher drop rate on very serious crimes still, even though the rates were going down on less serious crimes. That's a problem.
She lied to us, right, about her knowledge of or her input in the handling of that case. Do you remember that?
I'm sure she lied to us. I don't remember specifically what it was about.
We asked her if she said she recused herself, and I said,
but to be clear, then you're telling us that you had no directive to Joe to settle. You had no directive on the terms of this.
I could not. I want to be clear. I recused myself on February 13th
and had no oversight and no more knowledge than anybody else listening to the radio.
No, and I think what's important is it's either you recuse yourself or you don't.
And Webb found that she was being posted, right?
She said repeatedly in media interviews that she had stopped communicating with the Smollett family or anybody associated with the Smollett family after the police told her that they considered Jussie Smollett a suspect in the case, not the victim in the case. But Dan Webb found evidence that she was in frequent contact several times with Smollett's sister, Journey Smollett, who I knew and loved from Friday Night Lights. So, I think that opens a question, and I think that's where the disciplinary committee is going to have to look very closely at whether or not, you know, there were some false statements. That caught my eye because, you know, that's you know, if you know that somebody's considered a suspect and you're communicating with their family in any way and you're prosecuting that case in some fashion, I think that's problematic.
I didn't think we would talk much in this podcast this week about Mark Grace calling his ex-wife a dingbat. During the Cubs game last weekend, he told the story and three times referred to her that way, but Cubby and even not Cubby Nation noticed it. There was some controversy here in Chicago about what to do with Mark Grace. He was not subsequently scheduled for about a week of broadcasts, and he's apologized. But since then, Cincinnati Reds broadcaster Tom Brenneman, whose voice was on this radio station years ago, let slip a vile word used to describe gays. He did not realize he was on the air when he said it. I think today the question is, what do you think when someone says something like that and then follows it up with, but that's not the person who I am? What do we make of his apology, and should he lose his job over this?
Well, I think has Mark Grace addressed it? Because I think that it's just almost incomparable. You and I have been back and forth about this on the air. I wouldn't call my wife a dingbat, but I don't think dingbat is... I think it's like knucklehead. That knucklehead did this, the knucklehead did that. So I'm not sure I feel...
It's a gendered insult.
What's like, that?
If one of you called me a dingbat, you know, we'd fight.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
What if I called you a knucklehead?
Then I'd be like, you're a knucklehead. But
now, is dingbat, it's gendered because of... I mean, it obviously goes back to All in the Family, and this is what Archie Bunker called Edith was a dingbat.
I don't see gender with dingbat at all.
I do.
The only association I have, I've never heard anybody else called a dingbat. It's just, it sounds like a term they made up.
I grew up in the 70s with people calling each other dingbats all the time. And I'm sure my mom called my dad a dingbat. I'm sure, you know, that's just the way it was.
But I agree with you, Steve. I don't see it as being remotely comparable. It was a gendered insult at worst. I think what was bad about it is he's insulting his ex-wife. Like, that's just...
Well, that was bad. Yeah, that's bad for him.
That's bad.
But well, I'm not comparing the two, Eric. In fact, I think somewhere Mark Grace is going, thank you, Tom Brenneman, because this is apples and pears. This isn't even in the same universe, right?
No, I mean, the Brenneman thing, I knew Tom. You weren't here, John, when he was here, were you?
No.
Right, so I knew Tom when he was here. He would come in and do sports shows on the weekends and would, you know, do the Cubs play-by-play. And we're the same age. And but when I heard that last night, the difference is, and I know it's not fair to compare it to Grace, but Grace thought he was being funny with the story. The tone in Tom's voice was almost one of disgust, you know, like those disgusting people. And I was shocked by it. And you said, let slip. I think that's even letting him off a little bit too easy. He knew exactly what he was saying. We don't know what the context was, but it seems fairly certain that it was in a pejorative context. And it was a remarkable night. I can't think of a broadcaster being yanked from a game in the middle of a game for something like that. And then that apology that he gave was...
I made a comment earlier tonight that went out over the air that I am deeply ashamed of. If I have hurt anyone out there, I can't tell you how much I say from the bottom of my heart, I'm so very, very sorry. I pride myself and think of myself as a man of faith. As there's a drive in a deep left field by Castellanos, it will be a home run. And so that'll make it a 4-0 ball game. I don't know if I'm going to be putting on this headset again. If someone will apologize for the people who signed my paycheck, for anybody that I've offended here tonight. That is not who I am. And I'd like to think maybe I could have some people that could back that up.
Stunning in many ways. I mean, I know people...
Part of the reason it was stunning was that somebody hit a home run.
Yeah. Well, I just think he was... if I were in that situation, and I think I'm totally against what he said, and I think he should be severely... I think he should be punished. But I bet it seems to me at that moment of apology, he had to have been absolutely shell-shocked. I mean, think of it. He's probably lost his career. Live on TV, he's announcing it. And I mean, what do you do? That ball gets hit. He just didn't have the presence of mind to ignore it. I
thought the apology was more effective than I did. I kept score on that apology and thought it was terrible. And you thought it was...
I thought it was very good. Again, just because it came in the absolute shock of the moment. Now, look, I've said this on this podcast. I have a gay daughter. And when he said that, I'm like, you know... I was, it was hurtful. It was so disappointing. I knew the guy once. And so I think what he did was completely wrong. And I'll say even, probably hateful. He needs to be punished. But I can believe that and also believe that I think his apology, well, I'm not going to weigh in on the sincerity. I don't know about that, but the words of it. And at that moment, I mean, that was almost television history, really, if you think of it. I don't think that's ever happened before.
Well, he didn't,
I judge apologies on whether or not you take responsibility for what you did and whether you express sorrow for the people that you have hurt. And he gets two strikes in my book for saying that he apologized to anybody who, if they were offended, that's a big
right.
in my book. And he also said that those words don't reflect who he truly is. And at no point did he sort of acknowledge that he had dehumanized an entire group of people. I was not impressed by that response. And I also agree that the way he said the slur made it sound to my ear like it had something that he had said several times before and that he was comfortable using it, just sort of the way that it rolled off his tongue.
We didn't
hear the entire exchange.
We didn't, but it just was a very ugly tone, the way he used it.
Yes.
I'm reminded, did anyone watch the Hank Azaria show, Brockmeyer, where he played like a drug addicted alcoholic minor league baseball announcer?
I think I tried to find it and I couldn't find it. I heard great things about it, though.
Good. Yeah. It's great. And yeah, it's really difficult to find. It was on IFC, but it reminded me of that.
Is there a distinction in anyone's mind between something that you're overheard saying when you think you're off mic and something that you say in public? That is to say, he was not using this word in what he thought was a public way. Now,
that's an interesting question. I think that if you think it's okay to say, it's almost more forgivable. Right. Okay. So let's go back to Mark Grace. Mark Grace didn't think there was anything wrong with the term dingbat.
I called her the dingbat. So that said,
honest to God, I never thought it was a gender term until Heather just told me it was. So that to me shows ignorance. Maybe in some cases stupidity. I don't know if you want to use that word, but if you're using it in a private moment, I think that could be worse.
It's also not. He's at work. Right. Like, there's other people there.
He's a veteran broadcaster, right?
Yeah.
Like, I was going to say I'm not a TV reporter, but I guess I sort of am now. And, I should know that when, mics can be hot at any point, right?
That line kept coming up today on the show, too. And frankly, I think that's irrelevant. I mean, the fact that he was caught, we all should know that we don't say things in front of mics. I agree with that, but I think that's also peripheral to the fact that this guy uttered that sentence in the way he did. It's not just about a broadcaster being sloppy. It's something that really revealed something seems to be pretty ugly.
So I was at the gym one morning a while ago, and there were two old guys nearby who were chatting, and one of them used a really hateful term for people with mental disabilities. And I have a firm no talking to people at the gym, especially between 5 and 6 a.m. in the morning when I'm there. But I couldn't help myself. I wheeled around and I told him that I thought that the language was disgusting and disgraceful and that he should leave and never come back. And he turned around and laughed.
You kick someone out of someone else's gym?
I did. Yeah, I'm a very powerful, powerful person. But I think we all have an obligation to speak up when it crosses that line. And I certainly hope that, had I overheard Tom Brennan, that I would have spoken out against that.
Can I ask Heather, was it the R word that he
was? Yeah.
And that's a word that has evolved. And I don't know how old these old guys were, but when I was a kid, that word was used in the name of like organizations that were helping the mentally challenged.
Yes.
And then of course, during most of my formative years, it was just used as a garden variety insult that gym teachers would hurl at you and so on. Like this word that Tom Brenneman used. In fact,
I remember
teachers would use the very word that he used. My male gym teacher would use and coaches would use on the male athletes and students all the time. That was in the 70s. Now, that's not an excuse at all. And words change, meanings change, and No, you don't use that word anymore. You don't use either of those words anymore. But if you've got two old guys talking to each other and one of them uses that word, it's not like they're putting, they're not like they're broadcasting it. And I think you're right to call them out, and they should know that. They should know better. I don't know that I would, if they were friends of mine, if I would cut them off forever.
Because, or kick them out of someone else's house. because I can't let it go, I've looked up dictionary.com, the term dingbat. It says informal, North American, Australia, New Zealand. The definition is a stupid or eccentric person. I rest my case.
I thought it was a font, but that's Wingdings.
That's some journalism nerd. That peak journalism nerd.
Well, the other definition is a typographical device other than a letter or numeral, such as an asterisk.
Oh,
so who knew that?
You know, I wanted to go back to the R word for just a second, Eric, because we had on our show today a sports columnist from the Cincinnati Inquirer who wrote about the Brennaman story. It's a local story for them. And in talking about it, he was kind of agitated at our attitude. I thought that he was way too forgiving for Tom Brenneman's behavior. And so I don't think he much liked us. And it was a more hostile environment than I normally have on my show.
Well, hearing your guys talk, I want to congratulate them on being perfect people. I don't happen to be one of those perfect people. And I think there's a lot more to be gained here by forgiveness than anger. We got enough anger going on in the world.
And at one point he said, look, I have a child with Down syndrome. I react with hostility to people that use the R word to describe my kids. So I get how offensive that can be. But I think he was couching his sort of view of what Brenneman did as the mistake was he said it on the air, right? Like it's a microphone mistake or it's a broadcast mistake. But that's not what got him in trouble.
I think he was writing a column that should be written 2 years from now, because the crux of his column was that Tom Brenneman shouldn't be punished forever. And I don't disagree with that. But, you know, he was writing that 6 hours after the Tom Brenneman story broke, and it didn't fit. And we're not ready to be forgiving right now. Not that we won't be forgiving.
Well, and what is the definition of that? I mean, so like he... I think you could do both. You could fire the guy and forgive him. You could say, yeah, you're a good person. What do you know? You've changed, or I misjudged you, but I'm still not going to have you on my TV show.
Right.
Austin, you've been kind of quiet over there, soaking in all this wisdom. I want you to decide what is the appropriate punishment.
Oh, my God. I don't. You do have to recognize the firing is like, in the court of public opinion, is guilt. And if you fire someone, it means that, you know, your employer was not... Your employer thought they would face severe economic risk to their company by you being there. And that would be, I think he would be probably blackballed for a pretty long time, I would think.
Yeah.
But I don't think I'm in a position to judge whether that's the appropriate punishment or not.
Well, the Reds have to decide whether they want Tom Brennan to be the face of their organization.
Well, it's not just the Reds. It's Fox, CBS, NFL, or NFL football. Fox, you know, he does Fox games for the NFL.
Let's move on to the Democratic virtual nominating. It's not the DNC. Is it the Democratic National Convention? Yes. Is that what that is?
Yes. Yeah.
So the Democrats will this evening nominate Joe Biden as their presidential candidate.
Nope. He was nominated Tuesday. Tonight, he accepts the nomination.
Ah, thank you for that.
Is it okay to call Heather a nerd?
I am, in fact, a nerd. This is a true statement, a non-pejorative one at that.
Okay, a gender-specific one either, I don't think. Have you guys watched much of it, and how do you score what they've been doing, and what maybe can the Republicans learn from what the Democrats have done right or wrong? Eric, why don't you start?
I like it. I've enjoyed the lack of just foo-for-all on the floor. When you're not there, a lot of the atmospherics are lost on you. I like that going from speech to video. There's not a lot of cheering and balloon dropping and everything else. I thought the roll call was terrific, and I think they should repeat that roll call for every convention, whether they do it in person or not. That was charming and funny and interesting and touching, and every roll call was great. And the speeches, they seem like the speeches are shorter because they've got them in these tight time slots. I like it. I think it's good because it's been a TV show for a long time, and I think they've just finally made an honest person out of it.
I only watched last night. I didn't watch too much of the first two nights, but I felt like I was watching, pardon me, Heather, a fundraiser for a fund drive for WTTW. You know,
wow,
you had the host, you know, saying, and now let's, you know, we're going to go watch the Irish step dancers for 20 minutes, and then we'll come back and we'll give the pledge line again, and then we'll go and we'll hear from, you know, Julia Child. And then, so I missed the fighting and the cheering and the goofy glasses on the floor. That's kind of the show I enjoy. So, and I think the numbers, the audience is way down because of that. Having said that, I thought Barack Obama's speech last night was phenomenal. I thought Hillary Clinton's was good. I thought Kamala Harris did very well as well. So, I mean, I think you're right. You can say things like Obama could not have given that speech in a crowded arena.
For close to 4 years now, he has shown no interest in putting in the work, no interest in finding common ground, no interest in using the awesome power of his office to help anyone but himself and his friends. No interest in treating the presidency as anything but one more reality show that he can use to get the attention he craves. And the consequences of that failure are severe. And our democratic institutions threatened like never before.
You couldn't deliver it that way. So I think he did well there. But I miss the old convention, and I don't think there's going to be much of a post-convention bounce, because I just don't think anyone but the really, really hardcore true believers are watching it.
We've seen a concerted effort to reach out to loose Democrats or even Republicans. You know, we heard from Colin Powell. We heard from John Kasich. You know, we've heard from, you know, sort of the more sort of never-Trumper moderate Democratic wing of the party with much more sort of time than sort of the progressive wing of the party. Although, of course, we heard from Elizabeth Warren Wednesday night, and we heard briefly from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And, you know, I think that it's not so much that they're playing for sort of persuadable voters who are watching, but they want to sort of send the signal to people who may have voted for Trump last time around, aren't thrilled about it this time around, still have questions about Biden. They want them to see headlines like Democrats reach out to Republicans, and, you know, convention focuses on Biden's ability to reach across the aisle. So I think it's important to keep in mind that conventions have almost two audiences: the people who are watching, the nerds like me, who would watch even if I didn't have to for my job, but also the people who will see maybe a snippet here and there and who want just sort of like who want to sort of get a general flavor of what Biden is having this convention focused on, and maybe to learn a little bit more about him.
I liked to Steve's point, Obama's speech, where he talked a lot about disillusionment with the process, the difficult process of democracy, and that people fighting for some things today in a way that's totally unacceptable or violent is almost an insult to those people who dealt with so much worse and put up with so much more in order to change things the right way. I thought that was a very powerful message.
Did you see Kamala, Austin? I thought that she was... I don't know how to describe it, but so much softer. She wasn't, I thought that her speech was pretty tailored to an audience that is still trying to make up their mind about her. And I thought it was a very approachable Kamala Harris that we saw there.
More gentle demeanor.
I keep thinking about that 25-year-old Indian woman, all of 5 feet tall, who gave birth to me at Kaiser Hospital in Oakland, California. On that day, she probably could have never imagined that I would be standing before you now and speaking these words. I accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States of America.
When you do, like Eric said, take the audience out, you appreciate more the speech that's written. And I think her speech was brilliantly written and so nicely delivered.
Did anyone see the Rahm Emanuel interview on CNN before this convention? No one.
I saw it.
Did you?
I saw it.
What did you think of it?
I mean, he's been pushing this whole notion of the Biden Democrat for a couple weeks now, or the Biden Republican for a couple of weeks now. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, this goes back to sort of a longstanding feud between Rahm Emanuel and Hillary Clinton. Rahm never liked Hillary. Hillary very famously fired Rahm Emanuel from the Clinton White House. Rahm Emanuel just stuck around until Bill Clinton decided, okay, fine, you can, you know, work here. And he, you know, was, you know, very quietly in favor of Biden in 2016.
But I'm talking about when he started sobbing. I mean, oh. Yeah, that, I mean, that. So
I'm saying that this, he sees Biden's win as sort of a vindication of his sort of moderate centrist Democratic notion.
So he was asked what about the death of his father, I think. And,
that's when I tuned in
and he said Joe Biden was the first to call. And the tears just started streaming down his face.
Like the day he died. And he's got a lot of stuff going on. First one to call. And talk. We told stories.
He couldn't speak at one point. He said, he's a good man. He's a good man. And he kind of turned away. It was great TV. I mean, I don't doubt it was Rahm Emanuel. Right. I thought it was pretty sincere. And, I thought that was pretty fantastic. I'm sorry. No one else saw it.
I'm curious as to why the Democrats are not hitting harder on the three words that I think are the most important three words of this election, and that is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. That Ruth Bader Ginsburg, God love her, she's not going to last another 4 years, I don't think. It seems highly unlikely she'll last another 4 years. She'll have to, you know, she'll either die or she'll have to resign. So whoever we elect in November is going to appoint her successor, and probably at least one other Supreme Court justice. They're all getting kind of old. Many of them are getting old. And the lack of emphasis on the courts, and you're not going to see that next week. The RNC is going to hit hard on the courts and what Trump has done in appointing conservative judges. And that sets hearts a-throbbing in the conservative community because they forgive a lot if you give them the conservative judges that they want. And they have forgiven a lot with Trump. And if it comes down to like, gee, well, I want more conservative judges and I'll have this crazy man in the White House for another 4 years, they'll take that deal. And so the Democrats need to fire up the base that realizes how important the courts are, the Supreme Court and all the other courts, too.
Don't they already have that, though, Eric? I mean,
there's been a significant amount of polling that shows that Democrats don't respond to this sort of like, appoint our people to the court sort of messaging that's been very effective for the Republicans, because Democrats want to believe that their presidents are going to pick the best qualified jurists, and that they just don't, they sort of, you know, they feel uneasy by, you know, sort of characterizing the court as a political battleground in the way that Donald Trump does. And it's sort of that whole argument about norms and rules and that sort of thing that sometimes has left the Democratic Party at a disadvantage in this Trump era. But I think we're not seeing it because the polling shows that it's just not effective to move Democratic votes.
Oh, that is such ding battery. And I'm also very interested to see how Biden presents tonight, because the attack on Biden is now they're calling him Slow Joe instead of Sleepy Joe. They're trying to portray him as demented. And he is going to have to show himself to be vigorous of mind and body. And that's going to be really important. And I think it really starts tonight. I think people will. I know the ratings are not great, but you're going to have more people watching a Joe Biden speech tonight than you've ever had watching a Joe Biden speech. And they're going to be saying, does he look too slow to do this job? Does he look like he's up for it? So I hope that he has taken his caffeine pills.
Well, you know, I might have said this a couple of weeks ago. I was vacationing with some very conservative people, and they made it clear that they might have been Trumpers 4 years ago, but they are not Trumpers now. But then the one guy said right away, but the problem is Joe Biden is senile and you can see it. So, I mean, that message, that repeating of the message, just like the post office, the more often you say it, and, you know, if Joe slips once in a while, it's reinforced, people are going to start believing that. So I think you're right, Eric. I think that's a roadblock that's three quarters of the way set up already.
There's a really interesting Gallup poll out in the last week that showed a record high number of Americans, and I believe it was 25%, thought that neither candidate would be a good president. And that's both because of low on Trump and on Biden. And in among independents, it was particularly severe. Democrats and Republicans were basically the same on who they thought would be a good president. But that was pretty depressing.
Well, there was a poll I saw, too, where the Biden voters were predominantly anti-Trump voters. I mean, you know, Rahm loves Biden. A lot of people love Biden, but I think a lot of people supporting Biden right now are it's because he's not Donald Trump.
Wasn't that the subtext to Barack Obama's speech? I mean, for nominating his brother, his buddy, his guy, Joe Biden, I think the message from Barack was, we need somebody to save democracy. And if it wasn't Joe Biden, I think Barack Obama gives the same speech essentially. We've got this existential national crisis. And so who thought Joe was going to be a great president? It doesn't even matter. Just don't reelect Donald Trump is the bottom line to that.
And the question, the problem with that is that that is not enough to get some people out to the polls. And you have they have to actually feel some affection for or respect for the candidate if they're going to go out and pull the lever or mail in their ballot or whatever they're going to have to do. So that, I mean, that is their job one this week is to generate some enthusiasm for Biden on his own. And I, you know, I think they're doing a relatively good job of that. Again, if the ratings are low, it doesn't matter that much, but they're also generating some good ad copy. And
I think a lot of Democrats, Eric, people like you or whomever are just sitting there going, don't screw up. A shorter speech is better. Everybody's pretty much hit their marks this week for the Democrats. So the only big question the whole time has been, how's Biden going to handle it? And I think a lot of them are just holding their heads. Well, please don't screw up what we've got here so far. I want to talk briefly about something. Austin, can you kind of fill us in on the study that you sent me about COVID and how ill-informed a lot of Americans are on that?
That was a really interesting, I encourage people to read it for themselves, but Franklin Templeton put out polling on people's perceived mortality risk due to COVID. And what they found was across all age brackets, it's almost the same. People's perceived health risks to themselves for getting the virus. And they have a couple of really like speak 10,000 words style graphics in there, but you see each bucket by age bracket and the extraordinarily low risk of serious health consequences for contracting COVID, but a really high perceived risk that something really bad is going to happen to them. And I think it's important that people recognize that not in a political way, like, you know, you have nothing to worry about. Of course, we worry about asymptomatic spread and those people spreading it to older people. But it also makes it, and this is what Templeton said, it makes a targeted public health response really difficult when people are not being rational about the risks that they have.
Okay, go back and explain that again, Austin. So you're saying that the people think that they have an inflated risk of ill health, or
yeah,
they have a
so younger people, while that, you know, say 18 to 24, it's a 0.8% chance that if you get it, something serious is going to happen to you. But 60% of them think that something really bad will happen.
Right.
Those aren't the exact numbers, but that's the idea. And that's the perceived risk is almost, you know, flat across a lot of those people, even though, as we know, if you're over 65, that's
fascinating. So you're telling me people over 65 are think just like younger people when it comes to mortality?
Yeah, they're the only ones who perceive it correctly.
Oh, they do. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Pretty much. They're the closest. And it also found that social media played a big part of that, and even party affiliation. So Democratic younger people overestimated their personal risk.
But do they see it correctly, or do they see, when you compare it to all the cases, or if you break it down to cases among people of their age, I would imagine the death
among
rate goes
their
up.
Age, they don't perceive it, and that's the point. If you're perceiving your risk as it's 60% likelihood if I get the virus, but in reality, your age group, it's only less than 1%. That's a
of getting the virus or of suffering serious
health consequences from getting it.
Well, if you were going to get it wrong, I'd rather you get it wrong that way, right, Austin?
Well, you want it as close to the reality as possible, because the problem is when people stop doing certain activities, you know, whatever the reason for a perceived risk, that affects other people. That affects the closed stores downtown. It affects ridership on public transit. All sorts
of
things.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, the CTA and Metra. Metra will lose $600 million this year, and the CTA will lose $1 million a day. There's still nobody on the damn buses or trains. Yeah.
And the real that comes on the heels of that CDC report that found, I believe, 25% of people aged 18 to 24 had seriously considered suicide in the last 30 days. And what I worry about is the single young person at home hold up, even though they're not, you know, seeing people, you know, older people who have a serious risk, because they're not taking the facts into account. That is worrisome.
Okay, so then you're making.
So given this fear they have, what accounts for these photos we see of frat parties and dorm parties and kids jamming together on beaches and everywhere else?
University. I
mean, they seem very blithe about the possibility of catching it. Is that how do we square those two facts?
Well, it's not 100% of the people think they're going to be okay. It's, you know, about, I think for that age group is around like half and half. The point is of how seriously out of whack it is with what the reality is for their.
So if they were to have a more realistic view of this, like this is basically the chances that this will give me serious health problems are 1 in 100, even if I get it. Right? So that's right. What you're saying?
Yes.
Then what the hell? I'm not going to stay in my room. I'm going to go out and party and maybe I'll get it and I'll take that. I'll take the risk that I'll get it. And then I'll take the additional risk on top of that or beneath that, that I'll be okay. And it just seems like, why wouldn't you go out and party? Why wouldn't you go to and lick doorknobs and stuff? It's like, it seems like it's not that big a risk. So that if you're, but of course the problem is not so much that how it affects people of that age, but if they infect their professors, they infect the staff, that infects their parents. And I mean, it's like, I mean, that's the problem. That's why this virus is so insidious, right? Is that it doesn't present symptoms right on time. And then it spreads that way. So I guess I'm glad that younger people are a little more afraid than they should be rather than less afraid than they should be. But it's an interesting study. I wasn't aware of that at all.
Well, I have a 20-something-year-old son who's staying with us right now as he's going back to grad school. So he ended his lease and moved back in with us and is studying online at home. I don't want to say that I worry about his mental health, but he's one of these people that is absolutely not going out. And I think he looks at me like I'm being irresponsible.
There's a fine line between going out for parties and going to see a friend socially distanced at a park. And that's kind of what I'm talking about. If there's a way out of whack perception of risk for certain people, it's going to prevent things that they need to do to keep mentally and physically healthy. That's really important. It doesn't necessarily mean going to a, you know, frat party.
I'll tell you what, so all these kids going back to Notre Dame, I mean, if ever there was a student body that had every opportunity to be smart, educated, protected, not spread a virus, it would be the kids whose families are spending $77,000 a year to send them to Notre Dame. And they didn't get a week into the semester that they had to shut it down for maybe 2 weeks.
Well, but then if they had 218 cases, is that what it was?
Like it's on the football team now, too.
But that means that only two of those students out of 218 are going to suffer any kind of serious health consequences, right? And I don't know what is that enough to? I guess it is. I mean, I wouldn't want my kid to be the
right. But if you don't check those 100 and 1,000 get it, then you've doubled the number to 10 who are going to have serious implications. You know, I mean, that's the point of it, isn't it? I mean, I'm comfortable in my house, Eric. I don't want to leave, or Austin. I don't want to leave.
But yeah, you got to get out sometime, Steve.
I think you should. I think it's if you're healthy and you're well, fine. But if you find yourself depressed, if you find yourself stagnant, I think you need to tend to that the way you would a physical ailment. That's mental health and that's real.
I'm actually worried about what's going to happen in the winter. We've been able to keep our sanity by having friends over for socially distanced gatherings in our patio, in our back deck, on our front porch. John, you and I had coffee on my front porch a month or so ago. When that opportunity all goes away and we're back locked in again, we bought ourselves a patio heater, and I recommend that anyone who's worried about the winter rush out and buy them now, because I'm guessing there's going to be a run on them pretty soon.
Yeah.
Because we're going to try to extend the outdoor season as much as we can. But I'm worried about that. I'm worried about that the summer has been tolerable because of the ability to be outside with people, like Austin said, in the park, so on. When that goes away, man, it's and the days get really short, it's going to be just grim. On that cheerful note, John, what's the next topic?
Do you go with electric or gas heater, Eric?
Propane.
Okay.
We gathered with some friends the other night on the top of that bridge, the Franklin Street Bridge.
Oh, it's you guys.
It goes over the river. I don't know. We posted a video. I don't know if you heard about it, but we were sitting up there and pretty cool. You guys should try that.
You were very distant. It looked kind of packed up there.
All right. On that, I wish you all a good weekend, a safe and healthy weekend. Socialize correctly.
I'm going to Wisconsin.
Are you really, Steve?
Yeah, I was
no
worried.
No travel quarantine anymore.
It could not have been closer. It could not have been closer. Yeah.
Really? Were you planning on going anyway, Steve? Because you would have had to quarantine when you came back then, right?
I'm around an open mic. I know when not to talk.
All right. Stay well, all. Thank you.
See ya.
Bye.
Thanks, John. See you.
Bye-bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.